28th episode of Reverse Rock Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And as Alistair Cook makes two ODI hundreds and England whitewash Pakistan, welcome to the podcast that revels in the unexpected.
Whilst there have been all these shenanigans going on in the Middle East, actually the one thing that I've been surprisingly getting most excited about over the last couple of weeks are the things that have been happening off the field in Australia with the retirement of Ricky Ponting. It might be strange to say that I've been getting excited by it because Ponting is, of course, a joy to watch as a one-day player, undoubtedly one of the greats. But what I really like is the fact that it's a positive move for Australian cricket for him to have been dropped. It would have been nicer if he'd retired rather than been dropped. But having enjoyed quite a lot of success recently, quite a lot of surprising success recently, Australia aren't resting on their laurels and they're not trying to sort of maintain past glory. And they're looking forward, they're looking to create more spaces in the team, and I think this
is
positive.
It's an interesting point you make about it would have been nicer if he'd retired, because as someone who'd had such a wonderful, such a proud career, it'll be interesting whether he was given that option to retire. It's a curious one, because you'd have thought, for everyone concerned, it would be really nice for him to have gone out on his own.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing is, I mean, do you think this reflects the fact that post this India series, there is a new buzz about this Australia side, that they feel they can back you?
There's certainly a confidence that they don't feel that they have to constantly be reverting to the old players who are perhaps slightly past their best, and that they actually have the strength within the squad to go forward off their own back. It'll be very interesting, actually, to see what happens with Ponting in terms of tests from here, because I think this could be a real, hesitate to use the word game changer, but this could be a real game changer.
Hesitate to use the word
But I will. It feels like the right word for this kind of circumstance. Anyway, what's been attracting your attention?
Well, similarly, so away from Australia, to Mombasa, which Mombasa, a coastal city in Kenya, not known as sort of like maybe a hotbed of cricketing excellence. But I've really enjoyed and got very excited about this little series, this little tour that Ireland have been having in Kenya. It's been fun for a lot of reasons. Firstly, it's just been really interesting cricket. There was a four-day game in Mombasa, which Ireland in the end won by 10 runs. It was a real thriller, an incredibly low-scoring game. Ireland won despite being dismissed for 75 in the first innings. And Kenya were at one stage in a real state in their chase and then recovered thanks to a really good tail-end effort to get within 10 runs. It was really fun to, you know, very fun to engage with and follow. Perhaps the most thing that the series has persuaded me of is the fact that actually associate cricket is worth following. You know, it can be entertaining, it can be engaging to follow, and perhaps that's something the ICC needs to think about.
And it's nice to see, particularly with Kenya, who sort of had their time in the limelight a while ago, to the fact that they are still involved in engaging cricket and they're not just sort of become a fading force.
Right, well, I think Ireland have in the end had the better of the tour, but I think there's been a huge amount for both sides to take from it, and I think it was only a couple of episodes ago that we talked about in from the archives, sort of Kenya's kind of proud recent history and then the sad decline. And I think they've had a really promising series, actually. They've competed very well with an Ireland side who, let's, you know, be fair, you know, this is an Ireland side that really are at the top of the associate game. And Kenya very impressively won one of the 50-over games. And what was probably most encouraging is it was young, sort of relatively unknown batsmen who are doing the work for them, which kind of bodes quite well for their future.
It's been nice, actually, to see a match between two associates being able to stand on its own two feet in terms of attracting attention, exactly as you were saying, and it not being associates sort of catapulted against test match stations and getting absolutely smashed and then being written off.
And it's interesting, on the old sort of Twitter sphere, there was quite a lot of interest in the game, which suggested that, you know, it's not a game that people naturally take an interest in, but quite a few people are getting edged. Yeah. Away from associates, you've been disappointed by the efforts of, well, One of the big boys, not maybe one of the biggest boys, but still very much one of the big boys.
No, New Zealand have always, let's face it, they've always struggled in tests against the best test playing nations, and the series against South Africa hasn't been an exception to that. But they have always been able to compete in the shorter form of the game. And what's been really disappointing about the series against South Africa is the way that they have folded in various senses, the way that they simply haven't been able to string together a performance over 100 overs or over 40 overs that's actually ever really given them a chance to win. I mean, it's been a pretty compelling series, kind of despite New Zealand's contribution to it rather than because of it. Obviously, Richard Levy's fantastic innings in the 2020.
I mean, his innings, very good proof of the way 2020 has changed the game. I mean, this guy's gone from unknown to sort of cricketing celebrity with one
in. Absolutely. I mean, it's the kind of Graham Napier effect, isn't it? The way that that works. There has been the opposite thing has happened with Jesse Ryder, who is one of the finest batting talents in New Zealand, surely. And his slow scoring to lose New Zealand the one day was pretty disappointing, actually, in terms of what it said about the motivation behind the team. So
you do feel like New Zealand cricket constantly seems to be at something of a crossroads. Mm. You know, there's a desperate need always for it to kind of prove itself, and you feel that they find themselves again at that phase.
Exactly.
I guess I've been most disappointed in the last couple of weeks, not so much by a particular game, but by the actual whole format of the tri-series going on in Australia at the moment, the Commonwealth Bank series between Australia, Sri Lanka and India. There's been some quite promising cricket in it. There's been some quite encouraging cricket, but I just feel this series epitomises everything that is wrong with international scheduling at the moment. It is horrendous overkill. It is a ludicrous format in which you play a huge amounts of games that many are rendered sort of pointless to then come up to a series of final games. I mean, it's farcical, and you can only defend it in terms of the money being made from the individual games being televised.
Exactly.
There's no coherent explanation.
It's kind
why
of
you would play
sort
this
of
many.
Like having a the reason that you have pools and then knockout stages in the Football World Cup is because you have so many nations. But having effectively pools and then knockout stages between three teams, particularly when Australia have just played India in a series, I'm not sure it actually tells us anything new about the teams. It seems completely sort of superfluous.
It drags. It feels like overkill. And actually, frankly, it says a lot about how annoying the format is. That, as I said, some quite good cricket's kind of almost been lost amongst the tedium. And I think in contrast, the sort of the simplicity of the England-Pakistan series, is quite pleasant, really. You just have two teams playing a few ODIs, and it's a much simpler thing to follow and relate to. From the archives, and this week, Toby is taking us back to 1957. We're in Cape Town, and it's the second test between South Africa and Australia.
This was a remarkable match in many ways, because of the match itself, which we'll explore a bit more in a second, but also because it was really the coming of age of a certain Richie Beno as a leg spinner, as a cricketer more generally. And it marked the resurgence of the Australian side that would come to dominate Test cricket over the next few years. So the first Test in the series between South Africa and Australia had ended in a high-scoring draw, which, if anything, South Africa had had the better of. In the second Test, it was on a spinning pitch, and when Australia were put in, they sort of did what all good batting sides should do on a spinning pitch, and they spent a lot of time at the crease. They really consolidated, and they ended up having an opening stand between McDonald and Burke of 190, which took over 800 minutes, which I think is kind of the opening stand you're quite attracted to.
Yeah, exactly. That is sort of Test cricket in sort of the truest defined sense.
It certainly was,
isn't it?
And it was particularly good because the rest of the side only managed one half century between them, whilst Beno himself chips in with a defiant 33 down the innings. Australia in their first innings ended up with 449, which was good for the pitch, certainly, but it wasn't match-winning by any means. When the South Africans came to the crease, they tried to replicate that Australian method of grinding out runs, but they essentially fell foul of two fairly important factors. The first was that if you look to get in to score slowly, you need to make sure that you're actually going to go on and score runs. And seven of their batsmen scored between 10 and 43, but no one actually pushed on to a half century and more than that. And the main reason for that was the leg spin of the young Richie Beno, who bowled a lot of top spinners, which on this pitch led to more LBWs than you'd usually expect from a leg spin, and also more bolds. So the South Africans really had absolutely no idea how to deal with him.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's been a thought for a while about it's become a sort of stereotype of the South African game, that inability to kind of play spin bowling effectively. Mm. So it's interesting even at this stage here. But also that point about that balance between being patient in that environment on a turning pitch and still making sure that you go on and make a score. It's all, as you said, it's all very well showing the patience at the start, but that failure to actually sort of go on and build, obviously.
Yeah, and that was sort of the South African problem in the second innings as well. So they made 209 in their first innings and were asked to follow on, and they'd have to make more than that again in the second in order not to lose by an innings. They do pretty abysmally on a wearing pitch, which Benno is pretty lethal on. The South African opener, Tom Goddard, batted very well. He actually batted through the innings. But he kind of makes the mistake of holding up an end and blocking. But if no one's actually staying with you and no one's actually scoring runs, there's no real point in sort of just being defensive and not taking any risks. So Goddard sort of provides stability but takes away from momentum, and the pressure's just too much for the other South African batsman.
It's always that scenario of following on is always extremely difficult, isn't it? Because you have that combination between, you have that minimum score of runs in your head to make them bat again, and it's how you approach that. I mean, do you defensively already start thinking of saving the game?
Exactly.
Do you try and be a bit more positive?
Particularly because this was a time-limited game, this was a five-day game.
And I think getting the mindset right for following on is incredibly difficult. I mean,
exactly.
We've seen a few sides manage it, but I think it requires an awful lot of the batsmen, actually.
The South Africans they make something of a meal of the whole thing, and they end up at 98 for 7, at which point their mindset seems to collapse entirely, and they
surrender.
Sort of surrender. The match ends rather wonderfully with a hat trick, not for Benno but for Klein, the off spinner. And between them, Benno and Klein, they take 15 wickets in the match, which was perhaps more usual on uncovered pitches, but is a pretty impressive effort, particularly for both of them being fairly young, unestablished bowlers. What's happened in the rest of the series is this seems to give the Australians the confidence to play in a way that actually I think they've played with until very recently, which is a combination of real dogged persistence, which is what they showed with their batting in the first innings, when they said, right, we need to go out and bat and accumulate and accumulate and accumulate. That, combined with moments of absolute brilliance, like Klein's hat-trick to finish off the South Africans at the end of the game.
I think, what's interesting is when you look at any great team, you look at them historically, you can always look and try and pin down those turning points, can't you, when that team showed signs of becoming great. And it's very interesting, those sort of breakthrough points, because you feel like, well, they are the moments where that team kind of almost started to believe, started to think, oh, we are capable of this. And
yep.
Once a team has pulled off sort of an impressive victory once, the further impressive victories sort of come slightly more easily. And you feel like for a player like Benno, you need particularly something like leg spin that's so based on confidence. It requires that sort of patience and confidence. He needed a breakthrough game like this, a sort of real success.
Particularly with Benno, who is someone who never turned the ball all that much.
Mm.
He depended more on deception in the air than he did with movement off the pitch. And his top spinner actually became his most potent.
Well, it's interesting talking about the top spinner sort of in reference, I think, to the series we've just seen in the Middle East as a delivery, you know, in terms of what it... particularly both the ability of Syed Ajmal and Abdurrahman to sort of rush the ball through faster than the English batsman expected. And it's interesting, it kind of says a lot about the complexity of spin bowling. You're not just dealing, it's far more ever than just turning the ball as much as you can.
Absolutely. In the short term, this second test of the series, which Australia won by an innings, in the rest of the series, Benno took 30 wickets at fewer than 22 runs each. And Australia swept home with a convincing 3-0 victory. The next year, in 58-59, they went to England under Benno's captaincy and famously won then. And I think this match here is perhaps that moment, exactly as you say, is a turning point where they gained confidence and they gained a sort of game plan which enabled them to take themselves forward. ¶¶ And so to the book review, and this episode we have been looking at Richie Beno's Over But Not Out. Beno, known to many of us as a commentator, and it's easy to forget that he was a hugely successful Australian captain, a hugely talented leg spinner and a pretty feisty middle order batsman as well. What's slightly disappointing about this book is his description of his career, frankly, which is just a little bit dull. It falls into many of the stereotypes that we have about sporting autobiography. And so, I mean, I certainly was drawn most to the essays towards the back, where he talks about the state of cricket at the moment.
I think there's a sort of standard format, isn't there, with the sort of cricketing autobiography. Mm. And I think the problem is, once you've read a few of them, the autobiography of a good player actually can become quite tedious, unless there's a kind of honesty and a high level of insight. It does just become a sort of recounting
which I always expected from Beno, that he, if anyone was able to pull it out of the bag and write it really well, it would be him.
Maybe we should just get the bad points out of the way, because the other thing I was genuinely very disappointed with, his commentary on the 2005 series was very well known, his sort of signing out from that series as well. But his kind of assessment of that series, he talks about how, oh, this was such a memorable and historic series, and yet he provides next to no analysis of it.
And he doesn't really capture the spirit of it at all.
No, he pretty much provides a blow-by-blow account of it that almost any fan, frankly, could write, of the key events. And I think it's really disappointing for someone who clearly does have a wonderful eye for the game, a wonderful insight to it, that could provide no more. But so perhaps the sort of the real interest in this book is what we found sort of towards the end in it, where he gets more into essay mode and he really lays out his thoughts on the game. I mean, what in particular sort of caught your attention, sort of bad or positive or negative?
Well, those who listen regularly to this podcast, maybe I'm being presumptuous in assuming that there's anyone who listens regularly to this podcast, but those who do will know that I don't think that 2020 is the greatest thing that has ever happened to the game. Beno certainly does, doesn't he?
Well, it's quite an extraordinary quote. 2020 is one of the greatest things ever to happen to the game of cricket. Which is interesting for, I guess, lots of reasons, but primarily because of Beno's age, I guess, and the extent to which he grew up very much during kind of the pre-2020 era. You know, he played his entire career sort of way before 2020 was even considered. It's fascinating that he gives it such a ringing endorsement. And his logic, and I think you're going to have a lot to say on this, his logic is very simplistic. He very much says, can anything that gets this many people into a cricket crowd be a bad thing?
What he says more specifically, which I find really puzzling, is he says, if 20,000 people come and watch 40 overs of cricket, it is good for Test cricket. Which I find absolutely extraordinary. I don't deny the fact that 2020 can be good for Test cricket and can be good for the game of cricket as a whole. But to say that it is an absolutely natural and logical and a constant progression from people going to watch 2020 cricket to it being good for Test cricket is, I think, incredibly short-sighted. And a lot of the... I mean, I always come back to this wonderful idea of Gideon Hayes, that you don't change a game to suit those who don't like it. And I just think it's incredibly short-sighted.
Well, what I find surprising about it is the extent to which he pretty much measures success by crowd numbers.
Yep.
And I know this risks sounding very elitist, etc., etc., but actually there's a pretty strong consensus amongst anyone who's ever taken an interest in the game that cricket's about more than that, and there's an integrity to the game, and there is more than that. So I find it strange for someone who clearly gets the game to sort of say something like that.
Yeah. Just as a complete aside, a really interesting article, very, very briefly, really interesting article by Ed Smith on Crick Info recently, in which he talks about the fact that we all talk about why Test cricket is failing, and we talk about all kinds of things and how 2020 can help, etc., etc. And actually, the fact is that Test cricket is failing because there simply isn't really, really good competition at the top. Mm. And we were just talking about the fact that the 2005 Ashes, one of the most followed of all cricket series in recent times, happened before 2020 came in, and actually that it's the quality of Test cricket which is the really important thing. So in tennis you have top players providing great sporting spectacle, and if you don't have that then people aren't going to follow. Anyway, sorry, it's a useful aside, but it was an interesting article.
And I think it fits into that idea of where should we be looking for the cause of the problem, the format or the actual state of the game. I mean, in terms of the essays, I really enjoyed one where he talked about sort of players that he'd watched and admired, and he gave a lot of time to Michael Bevan, and I really enjoyed this because I think you read a lot of articles sort of raving about kind of the players who we've traditionally accepted as greats, like the Tendulkars, the Laras, And it was fun to read someone really kind of reminding me of what a good player Michael Bevan was. I mean, there's a wonderful piece where he talks about how he outthought the bowlers constantly, refused to be unbalanced by the pace of the game. And it was this idea that he could kind of, he as a one-day cricketer, perhaps, I think it reminded me of watching sort of Bevan play, particularly in that very famous game against England, where he basically put England out of the World Cup in 2003. It reminded me of quite how much he had mastered that one-day format, you know, quite how much he could master sort of keeping up with the run rate. And this idea of kind of really outwitting the bowlers and outthinking them, I thought it was, it showed a lot of insight on Benno's part that he kind of, he recognised the sort of greatness of a player who maybe hasn't really achieved that much recognition.
Yeah, I think one of the things that Benno is really strong on is people and talking about specific things in the history of the game. Where I think that there are quite a lot of sort of muddled thinking come through is when he's talking about more generally about sort of the state of the game and theoretical ideas within the game, about 2020 as we were just speaking, and also about this extraordinary argument he has about no balls.
It's an obsession. He dedicates lines to this.
He's absolutely adamant about. I mean, he is a polemic writer. He won't sort of see subtlety in these things. Just as he says, 2020 is good for the game. Full stop. He says that the front foot no ball rule is bad for the game, full stop. And as evidence for this, he cites the fact that between 1876 and 1967, fewer than 5,000 no balls were bowled. I hope it was him who had to count this rather than some, rather than some poor assistant. And then between 1969 and 2010, more than 30,000 no balls were bowled. And in that second period, it was done on the front foot. In the first period, it was done on the back foot.
Yeah.
And he says that, therefore, the no ball rule is a bad thing, simply because there are no
more. And he suggests that it's a failure of common sense. I mean, I think perhaps the thing I find oddest about this, putting aside the arguments to one side, is just that it's an odd thing to be obsessed about. It's an odd thing for a cricket fan to be to take a real passionate interest in. When there are so many kind of interesting issues facing the game of cricket, I struggle to see the no ball rule as one of them. I don't know, I struggled to see it as a game-changing.
And also, I think it was game-changing.
I know,
coming up
I
again,
used it and instantly regretted using it.
It's interesting that... I've completely forgotten what I was going to say. Yeah, actually, the front foot no ball rule is actually quite sensible, because if it's back foot, someone with a, you know, with a 9-foot leg span, although obviously those don't come
right,
up
we are that. Dealing with but, relatively
but,
a
but,
niche
but actually
crowd
it means that the longer legs you have, the further forward you can bowl from, so there are obvious reasons for it. And I just wonder which he doesn't actually kind of discuss. He's not exploring issues, he's putting forward views.
Right. I mean, not surprisingly, where I think he offers some of the most interesting insight is on leg spin bowling. And there's a rather wonderful piece in the appendix of the book, actually, where he includes the letter which he sends to young cricketers who write to him asking for advice. And there's lots of good stuff in here, but the thing that I take particular interest in is he has this real stress on the idea of patience. And he basically... he raises the idea that, well, he points to the fact that if you take a wicket on average every 9 overs in Test cricket, you will have a better strike rate than Shane Warne. And it's a fascinating realisation, because you suddenly realise, well, actually, a bowler as great as Shane Warne had to be used to the concept of sending down 50 deliveries without success, that was actually absolutely standard. And I think his stress on the idea of patience and of sticking with it and of not, for example, he stresses the idea that, for example, for a long period of time, you'll have to bowl your stock ball again and again and again. Simply, you're not going to be able to try and bowl a ripper every delivery. You get on top of the batsman through a constant application of the stock ball. And I think it's an interesting insight, because for a lot of young spinners, the excitement will be about trying to get the batsman out with some great delivery. But actually, it's such good advice to say what you really need to do is just stick at it, to be willing to stick at it over after over. Finally, to the debate. And this episode, we are asking whether to write about Test cricket, you need to have played it. And I think the key thing to consider here is that the actual experience of playing test cricket is fundamentally different to anything any observer can actually relate to. It is a game where the intensity, the constant intensity of a prolonged period of time, is something that an observer can watch, they can see, but having not experienced it, they cannot truly empathise with it. And that's why I'm not denying, I wouldn't deny that there are many great cricket writers out there who haven't played the game, but to truly see and understand and analyse test cricket without having played it is to do so without really such a clear frame of reference. I think what needs to be understood is that cricket exists on very, very different levels and very, very different planes. You can feel that you've played the game and understand the game, but to play it at test level, you've experienced something very, very different. And I think if writing is about anything, it's about comparison and analysis. And to do that without any personal experience of your own is going to be very, very challenging. I mean, we've had in this episode quite a considerable focus on the lovely Richie Beno, and something that obviously will assist sort of him as a commentator, assist him as a writer, is that he can constantly relate back to his personal experience. What is it like to captain a side? What is it like when you're out there in the field struggling to take wickets? And I just think it's important to recognise that however good a writer you are, however well you understand the game, you are disadvantaged if you haven't been in that position before.
Would it be churlish of me to point out that we've just roundly slated Richie Beno's?
It'd be a little bit churlish of you. I mean, Richie.
Okay. Well, we have anyway. So I think that point kind of makes itself really. What I'd say in opposition to that is actually that empathy and the experience of playing is only one part of analysis. Absolutely, there's an interest to that. But for the observer from the outside, there are issues that are far more important than actually the feeling of playing test cricket. In a sense, I'm interested in what kind of bat tape Alex Stewart used, etc., and how he thought about that, but you know, that might have occupied his mind for every single day of his career. But frankly, I just don't care. And one of the things that I get slightly annoyed about when I listen to past players talking is that they very often project, because they have their own set of view and their own experiences, and they very often project those onto the game in a way that I think is sometimes slightly disingenuous. The other thing which ex-test players who then become commentators lack is a sense of perspective, firstly. People like Alan Ross and Neville Cardus are hugely incisive cricket writers precisely because they have a frame of reference that includes expertise in things that are outside cricket. And there are very, very few cricketers, particularly in the 21st century, when the game is professional, the game is all-consuming. There are very, very few cricketers who have that sense of reference.
I'm not suggesting that I think you are capable of writing interestingly about the game, and I'm not suggesting that that outside experience wouldn't help you. I think you just need to see that. To give you an example, if you are analysing and commenting or even criticising a captain's decision-making in a test match with no experience of having been out there in the field, of having dealt with a comparable situation, I think it does lessen the level of your insight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, well, I don't know if it lessens it. I think it gives you a different insight into it. But I think that it's slightly disingenuous to say that there's only... I mean, I think essentially they're very different types of perspective. And I don't think that one is necessarily more valid than the other. I mean, I think actually one of the big things for me is that it is very, very rare to have an ex-player who is a really good communicator. Mm. Mike Atherton is an exception.
He's made a real niche, actually,
I can't think of anyone else who can think simultaneously really intelligently about the wider issues in the game and combine that absolutely with the experience of having, you know, faced down Curtly Ambrose and, you know, feeling the fear at the bottom of his stomach knowing that his head was about to be knocked off. And that actually what is perhaps most important, maybe not most important, but certainly a vital ingredient for any kind of commentator, is the ability to communicate. And I think...
I suppose you are... They're sort of two very separate abilities. I mean, that experience at test level and then that ability to write. But what I would suggest is someone like Atherton, someone also like Ed Smith, who we sort of discussed earlier in the program, I mean, why their analysis has become not just so impressive, but so popular, you know, it's enjoyed so much kind of acclaim, is the fact that they can draw on both. And I would agree with you that it's a rare combination. I would agree with you that there are an awful lot of test players who aren't blessed with that communication ability. But someone like Ed Smith, someone like Atherton, who do have both, who are both great communicators, and also...
Just like you, in fact.
Great communicators like myself, and have that experience. I mean, they are in a truly privileged position.
Okay, so Ed Smith, who played... I'm talking entirely off the top of my head now because I can't actually remember.
A couple.
He played two or three tests for England. Does that automatically give him more insight into the game than Simon Hughes, who played no tests for England, for instance? I mean, I have a slight difficulty is this hang-up on... So you say that, for instance, the experience of... Mike, I mean, it's my example, but Mike Atherton facing down Curtly Ambrose, that experience of batting there. Mm. I mean, I have had, and yes, on a completely different scale, but similarly, I have had the experience of being absolutely terrified while someone bloody quick has bowled straight at me, you know, with bouncers. I mean, it's not something that's exclusive to test cricketers.
I don't think it's comparable, though, and I think this is the point
maybe talking about maybe levels. Talking about me is disingenuous, but talking about Simon Hughes, for instance, who is who knows. I mean, I would defy you to say that Simon Hughes doesn't know the experience of playing cricket as well as anyone on the planet.
So Simon Hughes is a great pundit and a very talented pundit. The point I would just make, though, is that there is something... Simon Hughes played first-class cricket at the highest level, but he did never play it. He never played a test for his country. And I think there is a different experience, that experience of playing, firstly, at that higher level, and secondly, as much as anything, the pressure and responsibility that comes with it. I don't think... anyone who's played county cricket and not international cricket can relate to the extremes of pressure involved.
Okay,
so
essentially the only thing that being a test player above being a county player brings you is knowing about pressure.
Because it's
presumably not a technical thing, because you face test bowlers when you're playing at county level.
Right, but I think...
So it's simply the mental aspect?
Not quite, because I think the pressure's part of it, but also the continuing high standard. So, for example, county cricket is likely to be much more of a mixed bag of sort of the good and the bad. I think what is difficult to perhaps relate to is the continuing, consistent quality that the test game
absolutely.
Would involve.
I agree. I'm not arguing that test cricket is no different from county cricket. I'm simply wondering the extent to which actually knowing... something, you know, having experience that actually relates to your being able to analyse things better. So Simon Hughes will have experienced in his periods playing for Middlesex. You know, when he played against Somerset and they had, you know, Botham and whoever batting against him, he experienced a period of high pressure.
Yeah.
And I don't... What I don't entirely agree with is the idea that it makes you... automatically makes you better able to interpret and to understand if you have experienced something. I think there's more to it than that.
I think what I would say, kind of moving away, I guess, from the main sort of argument of the debate onto sort of the bigger issue here, is we are going through a really interesting time in terms of the press box as a whole. I think it's really interesting to look at the composition of the press box, see how many ex-players there are, see how many professional cricket writers there are. And I think at a time when... a lot of the national papers are laying off county cricket writers en masse. It's kind of interesting to think about the future of cricket journalism. And I mean, perhaps this is a topic for another debate, but this idea of, you know, who is likely to continue to provide this analysis? Because increasingly, if you look at Sky, if you look at the big newspapers, they increasingly do turn to ex-players. And I mean, despite the side of the debate I've been arguing, I do still think there's a very, very strong role for... really good professional cricket writers who've made their role in writing it.
Yeah, no,
it'd be interesting where they fit in this sort of future.
There is certainly a role, but I think ultimately we're going to end up slightly agreeing with each other.
We always do.
I think there absolutely is a role for professional cricketers, but I think there is a perspective that is lent by people who aren't closely tied up in the game that is an incredibly useful one.
Thank you for listening to the 28th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. We'll be with you again in 2 weeks, where you can expect much, much more of the same, but
a little bit different.